This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
So, Mom, is this a good time to talk?
Yep.
So, I'm doing a show about nostalgia, and it brought me...
You're tuned in to the Evening Edition. I'm Ezra Zaid.
Well, of course, because...
My mom, Suliana, she celebrated a milestone birthday last year, and there was a dinner party. She was surrounded by family and friends and loved ones. You know, there were presents, decorations, the works. And at one point in the evening, the family presented a video that chronicled her life. It was more of a documentary, in fact. You know, video footage of her childhood, photos of her teenage and adult years. Do you remember what you saw?
Oh, yeah, lots of memories of our friends, family, old friends, especially time at college, time at uni.
Could you describe what you felt or what you remember you felt?
Overwhelmed. Some sort of, you know, the tears come to your eyes because it's not tears of sadness, but tears of joy, tears of remembering, tears and or feelings of... happiness of what went through, of achievements, of love and about closeness with people. A lot of things go through your mind when you go, you know, when it all flashes in front of you. I always have fond memories of my past, especially my time with friends, time when I was studying overseas and, you know, you do all kinds of stuff. And it's nice to sometimes remember the good times. And of course, there were some bad times. But I think you remember more of the good times, actually.
Do you like the sensation of looking at videos and photos? You know, with Facebook now, they have this thing where 5 years ago you used to do that. Do you like that?
Oh, yes, I do. Yes, I just saw one just popped up. And I said, oh, my God, it's already 5 years already, you know, things like that. But then it will then trigger even more memories around that time of what happened during that particular occasion. So, yes, I do like, you know, remembering what happened and all that.
And as you're getting older, do these...
Younger.
or younger. Do these memories have greater significance?
Well, of course, because in the sense that we, you know, there are a lot of things that you are not able to do now and the things have passed and you're not there anymore. For example, I have very fond memories of my time in Australia and when my children were studying there and, of course, in Canada. But that's past now. And so, you know, you can't relive it again, but you can relive it in your memories.
Thanks, Ma.
Okay.
Bye.
I don't know. Bye.
On the show today, we'll take a deep dive into nostalgia, about what it means, what it does to you, about how it shapes and informs our childhood and adulthood.
Nostalgia allows you the opportunity to remember who you are really. Who were you at that time in your life when all you had to be in order to be loved or accepted or respected was the person you are?
Now that's my guest, Dr. Christine Baccio.
I'm a professor of psychology at Lemoyne College in Syracuse, New York. I also am a licensed psychologist, but my primary role is being a professor.
Dr. Christine, you just heard this conversation I had with my mom, and I found it interesting about how she described nostalgia and also about how other things get triggered. Could you tell me more about that process of looking at something from the past, be it through photos or videos, and what it does to you?
First of all, there are some obvious triggers for nostalgia, and we all know what they are. Things like special occasions, holidays, certain seasons of the year even. Transitions are very important. So if someone is, for example, changing their career path, they've lost one job or they've quit one job and they're going to start another. Transitions such as marriages or having a child, a divorce. So transitions can be good or bad, but change is stressful. We've known that for many decades. And in those time periods, nostalgia is triggered, which was one of the first realizations I had from my research data, that that's why nostalgia serves a good function. It anchors us. When change occurs, one of the reasons why it's frightening is because of the fear of the unknown, which we've carried with us from our childhood, really. It's a natural, universal feeling. Since you don't know what the future is going to bring, that can really make you feel very nervous, very anxious. There can be other triggers. Music can be an excellent, powerful trigger. Right now, there are studies going on where they're using music to help even elderly patients who are struggling with any of the memory disorders, any of the dementias, such as Alzheimer's, to make contact with the healthier part, the happier part of their lives. And even these very compromised individuals almost seem to come back to life again, psychologically speaking, when they hear the music that they remember from their past. Sometimes they can sing along. Sometimes they can play a musical instrument along. So there are triggers like those that we can hunt for and determine through our little personal investigations. Photographs, you mentioned earlier, video. Today, people are storing video that will eventually be useful that way.
I've always wondered whether we're limited by the types of memories that we can recall and about how significant are some of these memories that are buried deep, deep down inside of us and that we don't consciously remember.
The memories that don't spring to mind are the ones that the psychoanalytic tradition has always considered really important, because the argument is just because you don't consciously remember it, that does not mean that it's not affecting you. It is. Healing came from insight and uncovering those unconscious or subliminal memories is an important part of disclosure. So an example of that would be, as adults, if we're struggling with our self-confidence and we lack self-esteem, that might be holding us back in terms of our career progress or our relationship happiness. It's important to try to retrace our steps in our life story and to figure out, where did this begin? Why do I lack confidence? And interestingly enough, sometimes an adult figures it out and they realize that if their parents were very strict with them, they might, as children, have been very frightened and nervous. Oh, if I do the wrong thing, I might get spanked. Or if I do the wrong thing, maybe they won't love me as much as they love my brother or my sister. Those kinds of feelings, my data show, really do correlate with less favorable coping strategies when we're adults. Figuring that out can be a very useful tool for personal growth as adults. Nostalgia allows you the opportunity to remember who you are really. Who were you at that time in your life when all you had to be in order to be loved or accepted or respected was the person you are? You didn't have to do anything to earn it. And that might be when you were 3 years old or 10 years old or 20 years old. It doesn't matter what the exact chronological age is. The important point is that it was a time in your past when someone loved you just for who you are. And that's a very important feeling to have as you move forward.
My guest is Dr. Christine Baccio, professor of psychology at Le Moyne College in New York, and we're talking about nostalgia and its relationship to childhood and adulthood. More on this only on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Be firmly motivated. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to the Evening Edition. I'm Ezra Zayed. We're continuing our exploration about nostalgia and the impact it has on childhood and adulthood. My guest is Dr. Christine Baccio. She's a professor of psychology at Le Moyne College in New York. Dr. Christine, just dialing back into history a tad before we move forward on this discussion, what I wasn't aware of was how nostalgia had this kind of bad rep in the past, in that it was perceived negatively. Could you tell us why that was the case, and perhaps when did that negative connotation evolve and change to something else?
That's an excellent question. Originally, when I read the research literature about nostalgia, it was predominantly unfavorable. And that was based, I found, on theory. This is back in the 1990s. There was a lot of psychoanalytic theory that stems all the way back to Freudian constructs, looking at nostalgia as a retreat, as a regression, going back to older times. And in our culture, which is very future-oriented, we're very progressive. People can't wait to get the latest of any gadget that's out there. Technology shows are so popular that nostalgia, in terms of looking to the past, appeared to be almost dysfunctional. And strangely enough, the word nostalgia was coined. It's a made-up word. It was made up in 1688 by a physician named Hoffer, and he used it really to label what he considered to be a medical disease, one that in its most serious form can kill you. So he thought of it as a potentially fatal illness. Even in the middle of the 20th century, the first social science types of publications by psychologists around the 1950s were still predominantly unfavorable. And the reason for that, I believe, I worked on the history of this somewhat and published an article on the history of it as a psychological construct, was that it was defined primarily as homesickness. And as time went on and we became more and more mobile in many, many ways, just physically moving away from our places of birth, moving away from our nuclear family, and as time went on, we started to have the communication devices all the way up to present day. We have the internet and digital communications, such that home became more of an idea than an actual geographical place. So today, people don't often think of the house that they grew up in as their home necessarily. They might not even have had one stable physical place to grow up in. So home became a broader idea, and that led the idea of nostalgia to be changed, to semantically evolve into this notion of not just being homesick for your home, but to be longing for, yearning for, missing your past, your personal life history. And that changed everything. And it wasn't until really I began collecting social science data, which I began in 1995, that it started to become more and more apparent that nostalgia is actually a good, healthy experience. I thought it might be because the question kept nagging me. Since it's universal, and it is, everyone can feel nostalgic. Even young children can be nostalgic. And it's universal across cultures, across historical time periods. You can find references to it in the scriptures that go back a couple thousand years or more, that it must have a good psychological function or else it wouldn't be so universal.
And if we take a look at that process and how it's now perceived, does that experience differ from person to person? And do different people engage in nostalgia in the same way? And I'm wondering if it's even possible to even maybe modify those processes.
I believe that we can. There is a small clinical literature that dates back a little bit where it was first the therapists, the clinicians who were using nostalgia as a tool. People vary in their predispositions to becoming nostalgic. And there is some reason to think that there are even extremes or excessive tendencies toward nostalgia, that they might be unhealthy unless you learn how to harness the power of them. Like any other tool, I understand nostalgia or even reverie or remembrance as a tool. You can use it in a healthy way, or unfortunately, I think it can become dysfunctional if it's used as an escapism for the most part, in most studies, it generally is not used as escapism. But for individuals who've experienced traumatic or unhappy childhoods, they might start relying on nostalgia as an unhealthy tool to try to escape from stress, and that would not be wise. But I believe you can learn to use it in a healthy fashion.
You know, this conversation, I mean, it reminds me about how nostalgia is such a double-edged sword, because our lives are formed by all sorts of memories from the past. So is the quality of the experience dependent on whether someone had a happy childhood, or are our memories configured along the way so that it serves a specific purpose of nostalgia?
Even people who've gone through rather traumatic experiences can still be nostalgic. And that in itself is an important observation, because it tells us then that nostalgia can also be more than just a good feeling or an entertaining feeling. It's not just about feeling good. It's more than that. It can be healing. It can help us to recuperate, even from bad experiences. There was a small clinical literature, for example, on nostalgia among survivors of the Holocaust from the Second World War. And in their elderly years, these individuals engaged in nostalgic reminiscence as they thought about their mortality in their later years, deal with the traumas that they had endured when they were young people. So it's not necessary that you've had a happy childhood, but it is true that my data more recently show that there is a correlation. If someone perceives that they've had a happier childhood, then they are more likely to be predisposed to becoming nostalgic. So that correlation does exist.
And when we talk about nostalgia, I think to some degree it relates to a longing for happiness. And you've written articles about how happiness has meant different things during different periods of history. And when you throw in how different cultures experience and express that, how do we even define happiness in this context?
We have become, as a people, so enamored of becoming happy that there's an entire journal, a psychology journal called the Journal of Happiness Studies, which tells you that there are thousands of social science research efforts trying to figure out how can we become happier, or how can we gain the ultimate in happiness. How do we define what really being happy is? If you simply ask people, are you happy? Most people will say yes. If you say, how happy are you on a scale of 1 to 10? Most people do give it a relatively high number, maybe a 7 or so. But that hides some more complex, important notions. There are aspects or facets. You can ask someone, how happy are you with your relationships in your life? Versus, how happy are you with your career or your job? How happy are you in your role as a parent or as a son or daughter? So the answer to those questions can be actually very different. So happiness is very complicated. More importantly, there is something that drives people to live and to thrive and to grow, which we don't really call happiness. We really more likely call it meaningfulness. It's more important to say that I feel a purpose in my life. I feel that my life is meaningful to me, rather than seeking out, let's say, sensory pleasures. Someone might not have a lot of financial resources. They might even from time to time be worried about paying their bills or being hungry or feeding their children, but they might sense a great deal of meaning in their lives. And that is a more important construct in a way to just the joyfulness that we often associate with just being purely happy.
Dr. Christine, I guess without getting into an existential conversation about happiness, in a contemporary sense, where does this expectation of happiness come from? And how much of a role does one's childhood have to do with it?
One thing we know is that the media is playing a huge role by presenting models of what people should be striving for in order to be happy. And that we've known for several decades now has produced a lot of anxiety and unhappiness in people, because you can always find someone out there who is earning more money than you are, or who has climbed up the corporate ladder to a higher rung than you have, there's always a reason to say that you haven't achieved as much happiness as someone else. That can be very misleading. And this is where I believe the quality of your childhood and the quality of your ability to be nostalgic for your past is so recuperative. It can help you to really handle the stresses of those kinds of demands that society places on people. What counts is not so much the actual quality of your childhood in terms of, you know, what things did you do? What kinds of money did your family have? What's most important is how you processed that. How did you understand it? How do you now, as an adult, looking back retrospectively on your childhood, understand it? So someone as an adult might say, wow, my father or my mother was very strict with me in their parenting. Now I understand why. And so they can engage in what we call positive reframing, thinking about those childhood interchanges, interactions, and understanding the significance of them, which as a kid, you really don't. The meaning of things, how important they are, or what they represent, is very, very different when you're 6 years old or 8 years old than when you're an adult. So looking back can allow us to process our childhood, and that it's the social aspects of our childhood that tend to correlate the most closely with how we as adults consider our childhood happiness to have been. So social interactions in our childhood are tremendously important and valuable.
After this, we find out from Dr. Christine Baccio about how we learn from our childhood, how we configure our identity, and the powers of observation. We're talking about nostalgia and its impact on childhood and adulthood. More after the news. It's the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Business, finance, and music. BFM 89.9.
It's the Evening Edition. I'm Ezra Zayed. We're continuing our exploration about nostalgia and the impact it has on childhood and adulthood. And before we get back to our guest, Dr. Christine Baccio, before the break, we touched on the issue of childhood and the interactions and observations children make and the impact it has. As kids grow up, they observe who they interact with, their siblings, their cousins, parents, and teachers. I managed to get in touch with one such teacher, Ms. Moy Yok Lai. She's currently the CEO of Methodist College here in KL, and I asked her about how her interactions shapes and forms the experience of childhood for so many students.
Every day as I go about my work, I'm conscious that I'm coming into contact with 40 students in each class. And what I do in the class will affect them. As someone has said, that the teacher sets the mood in the class. So I make it a point that when I walk in through the gate of the school, I leave all the problems that I may have had at home or elsewhere at the gate. You see, we are all molded by the people we come into contact with. And I realized that as a teacher, I had tremendous power in my hands to lead a child to higher values or to destroy a child with the words that I speak. And I determined that I will never ever scold a child when I'm not in control of myself. And I will leave words of scolding or rebuke to another occasion when I'm in much better control of myself. Because the teacher sets the pace. Just as when I became a principal, the principal sets the mood for the whole school. Through the Monday morning assembly, what impact do we want to leave with them? So I had to prepare very specially for Monday morning assemblies so that the school begins with a good message, a message that serves to challenge each student and each teacher to choose life in the midst of circumstances that might bring despair, in the midst of challenges while they face exams, that they should choose life and live it to the full. So I am very, very conscious about the impact that my life has on my students. A teacher has tremendous power in her hands.
That was Ms. Moy Yok Lai, teacher and CEO of Methodist College, talking about childhood and the impact of teachers. And on that note, we're continuing our conversation with Dr. Christine Bacho. She's a professor of psychology at Le Moyne College in New York. Dr. Christine, I think about my childhood, and school has had a huge impact. My interactions with friends, classmates, and teachers. Obviously, you know, that's one type of environment, but looking back, home was equally important, and taking note of what was happening there as well, about how parents play such a huge role in forming your memories of childhood. This plays a huge influence when experiencing nostalgia.
That is true, because as children, the very first way that we learn about, let's say, who we are, our self-worth, our identity, and who we're going to be in terms of how other people interact with us, is done partly through observation. When a child observes his parents, that child is learning about how people get along. If there's a lot of domestic conflict in a home, for instance, the lesson that a child is learning is that, well, people don't get along very well, or it's very difficult for people to get along, and the way you resolve disputes is to argue or to yell or worse than that. And my data show that adults who remember, and believe me, children who've been exposed to that kind of home life, they do remember it. And it bothers them as adults. And when they think about it, they, as adults now, grown-up children, are more likely to fall victim to things like substance abuse or escapist tendencies when they encounter stress in their adult lives. So how we relate to other people as adults very often will either mirror and reflect how we saw our own parents and other friends and relatives interact, or a reaction against that. A good example of that would be an adult who says, as a child, I understood that one of my parents, let's say, had clinical depression or had a problem with alcohol. And so now that I understand why some of the unhappiness in my childhood home was caused by that, I'm very careful as an adult. And they react against that and say, I'm never going to drink at all, ever, because I don't want to ever fall into that kind of trap. So we are not victims, we're survivors, and it's what you do with that experience. This is where nostalgia can be very healing, because by retrospectively processing it from an adult point of view, you can make choices now, and you can say, I'm finally liberated, I'm finally free, I'm no longer going to be exposed to those kinds of experiences. We as children do internalize the best qualities. One of the reasons why childhood happiness is so important, I believe, from my data, is that childhood is the time in our lives of idealism. It's when we can imagine the best of everything, looking for the good in people. And my advice to people who deal with children, whether it's professionally as a teacher or personally as a parent or a guardian, it's really important to think of the emotional components, because that's what survives the longest. If a child feels anxious, nervous, or fearful, that affects them in a negative way for years to come. And if they feel loved and they feel happy, then they're allowed to fantasize, to imagine, to engage in that carefree innocence of childhood, which, believe me, is becoming shorter and shorter, because children now, in some ways, I think, are unfortunately being pressured to hurry up and grow up. They're being exposed to the worst parts of life way too early in their lives. It's really important for us to treasure and to protect children's sense of innocence as long as is reasonably possible, because then that child who feels good about, let's say, school, not only might they someday want to become a teacher, like those teachers they admired, but they also might have a sincere love for learning. Every child starts off with a love for learning because it's discovering. and discovery is exciting and wonderful. It's very sad if teachers or other people, relatives, older people, interfere with that and make a child feel nervous. Will I score high enough on a test? That's a terrible pressure to put on a young person. In fact, in some school districts, there is discussion about delaying giving grades to children. Why should we give a grade to an 8-year-old? That tells an 8-year-old something about their abilities, their self-worth, prematurely. An 8-year-old can come to the conclusion, I guess I'm not good at math because I didn't score very well in math in third grade. And what we know is that many children are more interested in climbing trees or learning how to swim when they're 8 years old. And so why would we give them a grade so soon, so early in life, which does begin the process of telling that child who he or she is? It's forming our identities. Well, the more that we can encourage children and give them positive emotional experiences, the better off we'll all be.
I imagine that the ideal scenario for a lot of folks, or adults more specifically, would be for someone to find that balance of engaging with nostalgia in a manner that is helpful and positive, and still be engaged with the excitement of the future. Does that sound about right?
It is, and I once looked carefully at this question for celebrities, and there are different kinds of celebrities, of course, actors, actresses, athletes. And in some of these areas, an individual is going to be at their peak relatively early in life. If you're a gymnast or if you're a professional football player or what have you, your career is going to end when you're still a relatively young person. So what do you do next? And that's the choice point where nostalgia can be used as a tool either for better or for worse. For example, if someone just wants to relive their successes of the past, that can hold them back, clearly, and that would become dysfunctional. However, there are great success stories where that individual looked back and said, wow, look at what I did, and look how far I've come. And now I have to reinvent myself. What am I going to apply that same kind of work ethic, that same kind of creativity to, that energy, that enthusiasm to? It turns out nostalgia is correlated with optimism. And so an individual who's very nostalgic tends to be an individual who's optimistic about their future and says, I'm going to reinvent myself. And some of these celebrities have gone on to create a foundation or to create a new business enterprise and sometimes give back. Paul Newman invented all those great products like marinara pasta sauce, and the proceeds go to charity, right? And you say to yourself, where did this come from? He was an actor, okay? And the point being that, you know, if you've enjoyed success, you want to give back. That's the positive emotion, because nostalgic people, that correlates with my data show, people who are highly nostalgic more likely to have compassion for others. They're high in empathy. They're very people-oriented people. They want to give back. And by giving back, you can reinvent yourself and start a whole new life, even if the life that you knew up to a certain point is no longer going to be possible.
And I guess just on that note, you mentioned nostalgic people. You know, there are listeners tuning in, and perhaps they're saying to themselves that maybe they haven't been engaging with nostalgia as much as they'd like, and perhaps not as much as they should. How would you propose that they do so in a way that's helpful?
One good strategy is to reconnect. And you can do that so readily. You can reconnect with an old acquaintance, an old coworker. Very often it's helpful to reconnect in terms of family sharing, reminiscing with family members about childhood activities, experiences, trips, anything really. But now doing it as an adult would do it, and talking about, oh, okay, so you are a little bit like Dad, aren't you? And then saying, but guess what? You're not really Dad. Because part of what happens is we start to restrict ourselves. We limit ourselves, unfortunately, by boxing ourselves into labels. And you can get away from that label when you make the nostalgic enterprise, this experience of being nostalgic, a tiny bit more social by having feedback from other people. And literally, the question can be asked, am I really that much like mom? You know, and having a sibling or someone who knows us well say, well, no, not really. You're like her in this regard, but unlike mom, you did this or that, or you're like this. And it helps us to sharpen up or make more precise the distinctions, our uniqueness, because each human being is truly, truly unique and special. And sometimes we can lose sight of that as we try to see ourselves by looking at ourselves as replicas of someone else.
Dr. Christine, thank you so much for your time. My guest has been Professor of Psychology at Le Moyne College in New York, Dr. Christine Baccio. This episode was produced with assistance by Sherry Lowe. If you missed any part of this program, download the podcast, and you can do so by downloading the BFM 89.9 app at Google Play or Apple's App Store. It's the evening edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.